Hey, this is Jeremy Roenick, and guess what? You guys are listening to the Jim Bob Show.
Hey, this is Wayne Larrabee, and you're listening to Roar on WGN.
Hey, this is Jim McMahon, and you're listening to the Jim Bob Show.
I had to pop a beer for this one.
Attaboy.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Brian Urlacher, and you're listening to the Jim Bob Show.
That's awesome.
Oh,
that's
it. How about one? This is Brian Urlacher. I'm not a bitch.
No.
That's about, love that one.
Half the coaches in the league. The Mondays were the worst. And that's when you really got tested, when you came off a tough loss. You got into the office on Monday. You found out two more players were hurt. You didn't realize. The sky's always falling in the NFL on Mondays.
Yeah, they're 40-1, which is shorter than I thought. You know, it,
why aren't they 100-1?
Yeah,
you know?
I know.
720 WGN high atop Chicago in the Skyline City. It's the Jim Bob Show game day edition, heard here and on great stations all around the country. And Jim Bob on the line. We've got a Super Bowl champion, a Pro Bowl quarterback, a Houston Oilers legend.
And he also dated Farrah Fawcett. Let's just get clear. For a while. for Nooners. If you read Dan Pastorini is with us, ladies and gentlemen. And let me tell you something. One of the best characters out there in football history land, man. And I tell you what, I am pleased to have him on with us today. Welcome to the show, Dan. We're going to get into some really cool stories because you've got some.
Thanks, guys. It's nice to be here with y'all.
Well, first of all, my question for you is that, number one, I don't even know how the hell you end up becoming a professional football player. You played seven games at Santa Clara when you were in.
Yeah.
Literally, in the 4 years you were there, you might have played all of seven or eight games. And to be honest, I mean, did you ever think that you were going to play pro football?
No, I didn't. I worried about it because I had the chance. I was drafted out of high school by the New York Mets. I was a shortstop at Bellarmine Prep, but they wanted me to be a pitcher. And I turned them down, you know, in 1967. And because I went to Santa Clara because I could play both baseball and football. I wanted to play both sports because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So, and, you know, they offered me pretty good money and I turned it down. And then the next year they became the amazing Mets and won the, you know, World Series. And they had a couple guys pitching by the name of Nolan Ryan and Tom Seaver.
Oh, man.
So there was a possibility I could have been in that rotation. But spin forward four more years, I get hurt. You're right. I only played seven games. I was fortunate enough to play in the East-West Shrine game. And I guess the scouts had something to do with that because they wanted to see how I would participate against big-time college football players. And, you know, it panned out good for me because I was selected captain of the teams both in the East-West Shrine game and the Senior Bowl. And got some awards for most valuable player and most valuable offensive player, et cetera. And that drove my stock up because they, you know, to me, the game of football didn't matter the size of the people. You know, it's a game of chess. You're moving people around to where you want them and be successful. So it was a much better game playing with the big chess pieces than it was with the smaller guys.
Yeah.
But I was actually bigger than my center. He was about 6'2", maybe 210. And I was 6'3", 210.
Yeah. Well, and let me tell you something. You certainly had the personality. I mean, everybody that I know from that era, and we talked a little bit about it, is that Bill Bradley was my coach, and he glowed when he talked to stories about you because, you know, Billy, Texas boy, and I know you were in Houston for a long time. You guys had that relationship, but I could see how you'd be the captain. So, you know, I knew you had that baseball background and so forth, but if you hadn't pursued football, you probably would have gone that baseball route. And how do you think that career would have gone?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, you can get lost in the minor leagues, too, in baseball. But they were pretty adamant about wanting me to sign. They offered me good money. They offered me, like, first-round money. And I was drafted, like, in the 32nd round. But I was sitting there scratching my head, you know, saying, that's a lot of money. I don't know. I just like playing. I like playing every day. I was a good hitter. And, you know, being a pitcher, you're only gonna play, what, every 6 or 8 days, you know,
yeah.
So you be much fun.
But, you know, as far as, you know, making that decision, you know, you were the third draft choice in the draft in 71. You know, Plunkett's there first, and then Archie Manning. And, you know, here's a guy who played seven college games and gets drafted third. That would be unheard of today, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. But, like I said, the All-Star games helped my stock, you know, a bunch. So I was fortunate enough to get chosen to play in those games and, you know, had an opportunity to shine.
You know, what, one of the things that when we were talking, Dane and I were visiting about, you know, who we wanted to talk to is that, you know, after watching some of the calls that are made today on quarterbacks, and if you watched the game last week with Aaron Rodgers and roughing the passer call, and somebody was sitting by me and said, well, why don't they just put some flags on the side of them and then we'll cure all this stuff? And I was kind of laughing about it, but we got to talking about plays that changed the game, changed the complexion of not only that game, but also the career of people. And you were involved, you and Renfro were involved in one of the most controversial plays ever that really would have transitioned your career into a different way. You guys were playing the Steelers, and you want to walk us through that, because if that play had gone the other way, your career, and we can always talk about what could have, should have, what might have, could have, but I do think that that play was kind of crazy. And do you ever think back and reflect on it and say, God dang, if we would have had the opportunity?
Well, I, to this day, believe that we would have won that game because we had as good a defense as the Steelers had. And as long as we didn't turn the ball, the bottom line is, though, we were all pretty banged up. I had a ruptured groin. I couldn't play the week before in San Diego. And Bum came to me and he said, can you play? I said, yeah, I'll play. And I told the lineman, I said, look, I can't move. So keep him off of me. We're going to throw quick passes today and just try to control the ball, control the game. And we were doing that, you know, right up to the end of the third. It was the end of the third quarter, and it's a pass that I actually throw to Mike Renfro and Kenny Burrow and all those guys. I shut my eyes when I threw it, and it was a great catch, and it was a catch that actually changed the game when you think about it, because it brought instant replay into the game. So I'm famous for two things in making a mark in football. That was the instant replay and the flak jacket. So.
Yeah, you were the first one to wear a flak jacket.
That would have tied the game with the fourth quarter to go, and we were able to move the ball and control the ball. If we didn't make any mistakes and turn it over, I felt that we would have a shot toward the end of the game to win the game. And, you know, a lot of people, Steeler fans, say, oh, both, because you guys would have, we'd have won anyway. And maybe so, but I think our chances were, as long as we didn't make any stupid mistakes, I think we could have won that.
I feel like you guys had, I mean, the momentum was there, and that would have been just a complete game changer, yeah. Right? And just everything that Absolutely. Happened with it. And Jim Bob mentioned, you know, your career, obviously, then, you know, who knows what happens, you know, in the team and just how that team is perceived throughout history. But also, and talk a little bit about this, Dan, it's like the Steelers. The Steelers aren't the same Steelers if they lose that game and don't go and win another Super Bowl. I mean, I think it changes a lot of things.
I agree. You know, it was, you know, one of those things that just seems to happen in Pittsburgh all the time. But now we're in a position to where we had to kick a field goal, and now we have to play catch-up against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And playing catch-up against the Pittsburgh Steelers with time running out is not a favorable position to be in.
Yeah. You know, in regards to, you were part of that, you know, you got the reputation of Love You Blue era. And I was telling you, when I was at the Oilers in 90, Nick Saban, that's what claim to fame for me. I mean, I broke my back in, you know, preseason, but Nick Saban was my defensive back coach in Glanville. But I was talking to you about this off the air, is that Love You Blue was so rampant back in the 1990s. I mean, you know, I told everybody, you know, that was like 20 some years ago. I mean, it was still yeah. going on. You guys still resonate there. And it's a beautiful thing, I think.
It really is. I mean, I live just north of Houston in the Woodlands, and you know, every day when I go to the grocery store or something, somebody will be across the supermarket and yell, Love You Blue, you know, or come up to me and shake my hand. You know, hey, I was a great fan when I was a kid and all that stuff. I told him you could have left that kid part out, but that's fine. We take it. But I said, you know, it was true. The city was as much a part of that team as the players were. And when we lost those two AFC Championship games in 1978 and 79, people say, yeah, I was at the Astrodome. We were in. But what people don't realize is that 30 miles away, you couldn't find a parking space from the airport, from Intercontinental Airport, down the Beltway, JFK Boulevard, the Beltway, and I-45, down to the Astrodome. You couldn't find a parking space on either side of the freeway. People were on the side with their pom-poms, flashing car lights and everything else. The population of this city wasn't that much at that time. It was under 1 million people, I think. But I guarantee 750,000 people showed both years back to back. And we all looked at each other. Can you imagine what would have happened if we won? Mm. And, you know, Earl Campbell could have run for governor.
Well, speaking of that, one time, you know, I think it was 1980 when you got traded and Bud Adams. I wanted to ask you about Bud Adams and Bum Phillips and Kenny Stabler and Earl. Is I had a great opportunity to meet with Bum and Earl and Kenny. They came down, I guess it might have been 1984 when I was in the USFL. They came over and visited us in San Antonio. And I was curious, how was your relationship with Bud? Obviously, he traded you to the Raiders for, you know, Kenny, and Kenny was about 90 at the time, but he traded you off, and you know, you had Bum Phillips, one of the well, I thought was one of the best coaches ever. But I wanted to get your thoughts on both those guys.
Well, you know, we never really got to know Bud that much because, you know, he was always up in the suites with his cronies, his business cronies and everything else. And, you know, he'd come into the locker room, you know, after a win or something like that. But we really never saw him that much with the exception of negotiation time when he got a new contract. Bum was, you know, was a great guy. And the thing about that trade, you know, everybody thought that I requested to be traded. That was not the case whatsoever. You know, we played in 78 and I was banged up with the broken ribs and everything else and the flak jacket and everything. And we go up to Pittsburgh in the AFC Championship game and just got blown out at the stadium. It was a lousy day, you know, sleet and snow and all that stuff. People sliding all over the place. And they beat the hell out of us. And so I came up to Bum after the game and I said, look, if I'm the problem, get rid of me because I don't want to be the weak link in this team. So trade me. If you know, if it helps this team, trade me. I don't want to be the burden. He said, oh, he said, you know, get that Italian temper of yours, calm down a little bit. He said, you know, I kept pushing. He said, well, I'll make you a deal. He said, you stick around. He said, you stick around. If you feel the same way as next year, then I'll trade you anywhere you want to go. I said, okay, deal. Well, we go through camps and everything, the season. Now we're on the flight back. And this was the last thing on my mind. Here we just played a heartbreaking game, you know, against the Steelers where we should have won. And he comes back, and I'm in the back of the plane. I've had a couple of scotches by now. And he comes up, and he puts his arms around me. He says, you know, Daniel, he says, I love you. He said, you're a warrior. And then he just pops. He says, you still want to be traded. Well, this is something we talked about a year before and never mentioned it again. And I'm sitting there going, well, what's he asking me this for? I didn't know what to think. And so I thought, well, he must think that I'm the problem. So I said, yeah. I said, okay, gentleman's agreement. If that's the case, and you know, you do what you want to do, what you have to do. And he traded me like a week later. And I didn't want to go, but I figured if that's what he felt, then that's my heart. That's how much I love that team. And
yeah,
if
no,
I'm the guy, then get rid of me. It was a gentleman's agreement or understanding, but we totally forgot about it. And then years later now, at like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years after the fact, we're down at the ranch riding around. I used to go down to this ranch all the time. We're riding around in one of those little carts. And I turned the cart off and I said, I got to ask you something. Why the hell did you ask me that question coming back from Pittsburgh in 79? He said, I didn't think you'd say yes. And I said, well, I wish you would have told me no. He said, I should have told you no. He said, but I felt that, you know, you wanted to go. I said, that was the last thing I wanted.
Yeah.
So it was a misunderstanding, but mutual respect for two gentlemen. Their word was a bond.
Yeah.
No. He thought that if that was the case, that I really felt that way. I didn't. I was feeling really lousy at the time. And I said, well, you know, go ahead. I'm banged up. I guess I'm too injury prone or whatever. Get rid of me.
Well, I guess then in regards to memories and coaching memories, and that's certainly something that stands out in your relationship with Bum. But were there some others with Bum that you can recall that might not have been so painful?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, he was the type of guy when he first came on as head coach, you know, the first meeting he had, he said, I want you guys to get to know each other differently than you do. He said, you guys hang around in groups. He said, you infiltrate the other groups and start getting to know everybody. I want you all to become family. And he said, you know, you'll fight harder for your family than you will for your friends. And it's true. You will. And to this day, that is so true because I've had my little charity event that helps be an angel here. For the last 16 years, we've raised over $2.5 million to that organization for my little golf tournament. And every year I get my guys show up and show out. We probably had our best event this last week, but it was, you know, those guys are family to me, and I'm to them. We do hang together, and it's lasted well after our playing careers were done.
Well, you mentioned the love for the team, and then, of course, the community, you know, Houston and Texas, like, yeah, they love the team and still identify with it decades later, and you guys, right? And that relationship is still very strong. And the B&H Angel Celebrity Golf Classic, of course, El Bandito Yankee, the undefeated flavor of El Bandito Yankee, you always win. They were there. So our tequila company was there with you celebrating as well. Talk a little bit about the event, because it was a great opportunity, not only for you guys to get together and commiserate, but for all those fans that celebrated with you at that event for that great cause as well.
Yeah. And Jim, I understand you're a principal with El Bandito.
Yeah, I invented it. Chelios, Chris and I were getting drunk one night. It was 2:30 in the frickin' morning, and he's trying to push some other product on me, and I go, I don't like it. It's got vegetable glycerin in it. I like tequila. I don't like this crap. And I said, it's adulterated. And he knew I was buying a bunch of agave, and we were making agave sweetener and nectar, and I was selling to all the food companies I was working with, getting sucrose and fructose. And you know how it is when it's 2:30 in the morning, because you've had your nights, Dan. I know that. But I look at him and I said, yeah, I don't like that stuff at all. And he says, well, maybe, Mr. Agave, we ought to make our own tequila. And I said, yep. Here we are a couple of years later now. And thank you for asking, though. It's a great story. Chelios and I.
Well, we appreciate your support here. We had samples that were being used because of your participation, and we appreciate
it. We're going to blow it up next year for you. We'll blow it up. We'll bring the racing team down there bring that in.
Back up. You didn't mention anything about a race team. What's going on?
Well, this is where I want to see. This is how we segue. And so we do a lot with NASCAR and sprint car and
NHRA.
We got our NHRA bike, and I know all about your racing career, and I love it. I mean, and we got a couple more subjects to get in here. We got to talk about your movie career too. I mean,
everybody, we don't want to talk about that, but we can talk about Top Fuel anytime. When you want to go Top Fuel racing, you call me first.
We're going to visit about it, but we do a lot of stuff with the NASCAR. We sponsored the championship at NASCAR out at Phoenix and Scottsdale. Yeah. We own the infield and stuff like that, but we do a lot of stuff with that. And I know your race career. I want to go there and talk about that, because, you know, I mean, number one, it's super dangerous. And in my opinion, I mean, you know, gosh dang, you were one of the first group of guys to ever do over like 270 mile an hour. What was that like when you realized you just hit this milestone at the time? 270 was the number, and you blew through it. How did you feel after that? That it had to be as exhilarating as anything else you did.
Well, you know what? Anything I've gotten into, I wanted to win, and I happened to get involved with people that had experience and that knew the game and knew the business. And we worked hard. We had to not only find a sponsorship, but I had a supporter down here from Baytown, Larry Enderle, supported me from my boat drag racing and the cars as well. And hang on, I got two cats getting ready to fight. Get out. Go on. Get it.
That's perfect.
That was our first cat fight on the show.
We've never had a cat fight on the show, but we love it.
I wanted to get them gone before the hair started flying. But, you know, he supported me, and I had this team. We used to match race to support going to the NHRA national events. So we'd make money selling T-shirts and appearance fees and everything, doing the match races. And then we'd go piss it away at the national event and then start the tour again the next week. So we were racing like every other week, if not every week, to go to the national events. And my rookie year, we were seventh in points, and we won our seventh race. And we were getting down to the nitty gritty. And I told Larry, I said, man, I can't afford this anymore. I'm going broke. And in the meantime, I'm fighting Al Davis over a contract dispute that wasn't going to be settled for another 10 years. And I mean, I'm literally broke. And he said, well, I got a feeling, you know, this race, let's go to Atlanta and see. We go to Atlanta and I win the race. And that just turned it around for us. couple weeks later, we signed Coors. We had them for 3 years, and we still never had the proper amount of money that we needed in order to, you know, to really be competitive. But, you know, we finished seventh in points for 2 years running, and that's not bad. And we did win a Wally.
Yeah. No, my gosh, no. You know, we always say covering it, too, that there's no substitute for being there in motorsports and specifically the NHRA. Like, what was that draw for you? Obviously, you know, great baseball player, you know, Pro Bowl football player, Super Bowl champion, right? Now, you had your sports fix and you were identified. Like, at what moment did you realize, wow, this is cool, I got to get into this?
I was a racing junkie when I was a kid. When I graduated high school at Bellarmine Prep, I got a scholarship to go to Santa Clara. My dad took me down. He said, let's go get you a car. Took me down to the Chevy dealership and bought me a 1967 Chevelle SS 396.
Oh, man.
Four on the floor. And we had Fremont Drag Strip, which was about 7 miles or 8 miles away from the campus. And every Saturday night, go up there and do grudge races. And then naturally, when the national events came in, we go watch Shirley and Big Daddy. And when you hear a fuel motor, I mean, it's just, it's a sound. That
nothing like it,
you
buddy.
You can't describe.
No, nothing like
describe.
It. Nothing like it.
They're ground shakers and they shake everything. And I think when I raced, we had like 6,000 horsepower, but now they're claiming 10,000 horsepower. So it's a lot of horsepower, and it's a magical thing to garner it and get it down to those wheels and make them grab and hang on. And I mean, the cars just run on the ragged edge the whole time,
you know,
and you've got to be ready for it.
I go to one of my first NHRA events, and we're running the El Bandito Pro Stock Comp bike. And our rider, Ryan, you know, they're pushing him up to the line. And I kind of forget where I'm at, Dan. And because as you said, man, when those guys fire off on the dragsters and those 10,000 horse hit, it is like standing behind a jet airplane taking off. It really is. I mean, hey, you're getting your faces getting, you know, all the wind and everything. And so we're getting ready to race and I'm caught up in the moment. And, one of the, newscasters comes up to me and this is live. Okay. This is live. And we're doing a big El Bandito sponsorship there at the track in Joliet. And he goes, Jim Bob, he looks like Flying Ryan is ready. Looks like he enjoys pushing El Bandito Yankee as much as he likes riding a bike. I said, well, I sure hope he's focused on this run because we're getting ready to jump at 200 mile an hour right here. I said, and he goes, what drew you to the sport? And I forget we're on live television. Every other word is blankety blank, blankety blank, 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 yeah. Blank. And he's looking at me like, what is your problem? Do you not realize we're on live television? And so now, you know, they're getting ready to blow off the line. And so I can't hear myself because they're getting ready to, you know, they're warming up and everything. And so as I'm walking off and my fiance Amy's with me and she goes, oh my God, you know what you just did? I go, what? And she goes, you just cursed 10 times on live television. And so as I walk off, the crowd is like, the crowd can hear me, but I couldn't hear what I was saying. The crowd going, yeah, we love you. And we sold out El Bandito in about 5 minutes.
Yeah. They're loyal. I'm telling you, they're loyal fans. Believe me.
Yeah.
They're great fans.
Hey, I was going to ask you, you know, I was teasing you about your movie life, but, you know, for these people that taking back in time, Dan Pastorini might have been one of the best looking son of bitches running around. I'll just tell you, everybody hated him. You go, he's 6'3", he's good looking, he's built, and he's dating all these hot women. I mean,
Farrah Fawcett.
So, how did you and Lee get along? And you guys did a movie together. Should have won an Academy Award. Killer fans.
actually, Lee and I are good friends. We have a mutual friend, Michael Berry, and we see each other on occasions at some of Michael's functions. He's a kind of a political radio jock down here in Houston, and he has some functions. And you know, I've seen Lee many times. She was in between Lee and Ryan at the time, and I was just kind of a. Yeah, here's the scenario. We just beat the Dallas Cowboys in 1979 on Thanksgiving, and their phone's ringing in the locker room up there in Dallas. Kenny Burrow finally answers the phone after it's ringing. He says, hey, it's for you. I said, tell him I'll call him Monday or so, you know, when we're done here. And he says, it's a girl named Farrah. And I went, what? Because I had a tennis tournament that summer, and she came in for the tennis tournament. We got to know each other, and just, you know, casually. And so, you know, I answer the phone, and here's that voice in the other end of the line. And she goes, hi, I'm in town for Thanksgiving. Just wanted to see if you're maybe available to get together. And what the hell would you do? What would you say?
Where do I go?
My schedule. Yeah, okay, yeah, I'm available, yeah. So we did. We started dating. And then the minute we lost to the Steelers in the AFC Championship game, went out and had lunch with her in Los Angeles for the Super Bowl. She came by my hotel and had lunch. And said, okay, well, I'll see you later. Never saw her again after that.
Totally just used you.
I just like a cheap towel.
I mean, no conscience whatsoever. I'm just going to use Pastorini.
I figured it was a tonic for my ass. You know, what the hell?
Yeah, that is funny. Man, you're a superstar, super stud, and inwardly, you're just a great guy, great person. I really have appreciated talking to you. We want to have you on again, man. Is it? I've enjoyed it. I got a list of about 50 more questions. We're not going to get it fitted in, but we're going to have you back. I love visiting with you, and you would have made a great personality as an analyst too, man. I mean, you know,
Farrah Fawcett would have just DM'd him on his Instagram page and whatever. It would have been easy. Dan, before we let
you go,
we want to get
there. You go.
We'll have links up for the golf outing and for the foundation and everything. But if you got a website, places that people can go to keep up and learn about all the things going on.
Yes, I've got my website, www.danpastorinicharity.com. And then for Be an Angel, it's beanangel.org. BEANGLEL.org. Thank you, guys. Appreciate your support, man, and enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, we're gonna be back in touch with you. We're gonna blow up next year's event for you. We're gonna help you however we can, man. And I'll get Billy Bradley and I. We'll roll in for it.
Oh God, we're gonna have to get some extra security in.
We'll get security. Hey, be ready, buddy. We're gonna drink some tequila.
It's gonna be hard pressed for me because I haven't drank in 16 years.
Good. So. I'll drink all you
but need. But I'll watch you. I'll be your designated driver. I'll tell you that.
Perfect. See you, buddy.
All right, guys. Thank you. Love you, man.
Love you. Bye-bye.